This episode of Yes But Why Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
As it turns out, Emerson has a huge comedy pedigree, right? So there's like five troupes there that were all at the time like royalty. The troupe that I eventually joined was called This Is Pathetic. David Cross was in it. Laura Keitlinger was in it. Anthony, I can't remember his last name. He was actually the big star at the time too. He was in it. John Ennis was in it, which is how he got to be part of Mr. Show, because he and David Cross were friends with each other from college. And then there was a group called Swollen Monkey Showcase. And then there was Emerson Comedy Workshop, which was the like grand dame of the Emerson Comedy Theaters. They had been around for a really long time. And everybody had these audiences that would just follow them anywhere. And we got to play not just in school, but at houses all over town, right? Mm-hmm. But there was this weird rift between all of the groups. And writing partner, so I auditioned for the group, but I didn't get in. I got in as a writer. It was a sketch troupe. And so my friend Scott Roseanne and I became head writers. And we became very fast friends with a guy named Eric Drysdale, who is Rebecca Drysdale's brother. And he is now a 10-time Emmy-winning writer for Colbert, and he did Daily Show for a while, and he just quit working for Sam B. He did all that political stuff. And so the three of us lived together. And it was our mutual love of comedy and weed that brought all three of the comedy troupes in Emerson together. Mm-hmm. And suddenly everybody was like, oh my God, there's other people doing what we're doing. And like, we really like each other and there's no reason for this rift. And then it became like rock star time, because all the comedians went around with all the other comedians. We had these giant parties where like all three of the troops came and people were like, they exist in the same place, you know? And then the second year, Scott and I got into the troop, and then I eventually became president of the troop, and it was like a big deal. Pathetic occupied more of my life in college than actually learning things did, you know what I mean?
Wow.
My internship was related to writing comedy. I had a directed study that was sketch comedy related. I had a comedy professor named Mike Bent, who was like a sketch comedy professor. I had another woman whose name I can't remember now, that was an early on Simpsons writer. And I just got like indoctrinated into comedy, you know? And like I said, there was a pedigree. Jay Leno went there, Henry Winkler went there, Carol Burnett went there. It was everywhere. And they treated us, because we didn't have sports. The comedians were sort of like, and the fraternities were super lame. Like it was like the upside down of colleges, right? Like
I went to a college that was similar. We didn't have sports.
Yeah,
or Greek life.
None of that stuff mattered. There was like Division III sports, and everybody's like, yeah, good for you. You know, play your hockey against Mass Maritime, which we did play. You know, it was like, how do they have basketball players at Mass Maritime? We did that. And the Greek life was, there were fraternities, but they were like, meh. But we were like rock stars, like everywhere we went. And we had a natural enemy, which was great, which was Harvard, right? So we united against Harvard, because the Harvard kids lived in a fucking castle, like an actual castle.
But they weren't even allowed to have a theater major.
No, but the Hasty Pudding kids and the Harvard Lampoon kids lived together in an actual castle. And they were pretty much able to do whatever they wanted to, and they got all these, like, they did the Hasty Pudding Parade, the, you know, the parade that they did every year where they would get, like now it would be, like, Will Ferrell would be dressed in drag or whatever, and that's how they would do it. I remember one year it was, like, Martin Short was their, like, the parade grand marshal, and we were selling out shows all over the place, and our comedy, we knew our kung fu was better than theirs. Like, we just knew it. We would go see their shows and be like, ah, you fucking suck. And they got all the Conan jobs and all the Simpsons jobs because Conan went to Harvard. Right. It was like this weird network of, like, if you went to Harvard, you were a comedy writer. You got in right away.
Sure.
Which eventually became an Emerson thing too, but just in a different way. Right. Yeah.
So you're working towards all of this. What happens after school?
So at the time, we had two choices. New York was kind of off the table because it was too expensive and too difficult. And there were about five or six of us that graduated at the same time that knew we wanted to do a production company. We had done some... I interned at WLVI in Boston, Channel 56.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote promos for the... for the movie there, the nightly movie. And we would do like mini sketches for promo, like 15 second sketches for promos. And we got taken off of that because we did a promo for the movie, Troop Beverly Hills. That was there. There was a guy named Jim Cutler who was the voice of Channel 56, and he was amazing voiceover artist. And Jim was like Anchorman. He would literally read anything that you gave him. He made no quality judgment on anything. He just read the script. And he thought we were kind of adorable, probably. And so we gave him this promo for Troop Beverly Hills, which was, and now back to Troop Beverly Hills, I'm so happy I'm spotting. That was the rejoin, right? And Monday morning we got called in by the assistant station manager, whose wife apparently was watching the movie with him that night, and heard the joke and was like, did you make a reference to spotting on television? And we were like, yeah. He was like, you're not gonna be writing these promos anymore. And we're like, okay.
Ah.
So we got bumped down to doing like stuff for Perfect Strangers and stuff like that. But like those couple months when we were doing that, it's not very funny now, but at the time we thought it was like transgressive, right?
Clearly it was, because you lost the job.
We transgressed.
Yeah.
So then...
The trouble with being transgressive is it usually doesn't work out for you.
Yeah, exactly. Only the very famous get to get away with it.
Well, I mean, realistically, it's that you get to say you did it.
Yes, which is what I'm doing now.
Yeah, look at you.
Yeah.
Just, you did that.
Just 29 short years later or whatever it is.
Not going to lie, I probably saw that exact thing, if only just because I...
That was all there was to watch?
Well, I mean... I'm growing up at the time, based on when you got out of college, it seems right.
Yeah.
I mean, you're about 8 years older than me, so I'm in high school.
Yep.
At this point, watching this, Troop Beverly Hills, I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
Right? So.
There you go.
I can guarantee I was watching it.
I'm glad we reached you.
Yeah. Right? I love it.
So then, it was either Orlando, which everybody was saying, like, Orlando's going to be the next Hollywood. And we thought, okay. Maybe we'll give that a shot. And then I have a friend named Mike Landry who was a pragmatist. He's a producer now, and he's still a pragmatist. He's actually super amazingly funny and really great. But Landry is like a no-nonsense kind of dude. And he was just like, why would we bother moving to the next Hollywood and not to actual Hollywood? He's like, if we're going to do this, we should just go to LA. And so... As time went on, everybody sort of agreed with that, and we were like, okay, let's just do it. So there were a bunch of people that I went to college with, and we all moved to LA and decided to, since we had, the reason that I mentioned the promos is that we formed a production company to pitch ourselves to LVI, and they bought us as interns. So we kept that production company, and Vin DeBona, who... was the executive producer of America's Funniest Home Videos, was also an Emerson alumni. And they were looking for original video. So there was a time where America's Funniest Home Videos they bought video pieces from amateurs. It wasn't the like blooper videos. That stuff is actually all real. But they would buy like narrative video from people. So we did a thing called the Fight in 47th, which was a special paratrooper army unit that would be dropped in behind enemy lines to make people laugh, right? And we shot this, and they bought it, and they were like, we're going to pay you. They paid us $900, paid our phone bill, because back in the day, phone bills were very expensive. And we were like starstruck, and we were on our way. Like, we're going to go to L.A. We're going to be this production company. We're going to do this.
What was the name of the production company?
Soft Pants Productions.
Soft
because
Pants.
Because sometimes you need your softest pants.
Okay.
Yes, we were Soft Pants for a little while. And then the reality of having to get jobs hit. Because you don't just show up in L.A. as a production company, and you're like, we're going to be a production company.
You don't.
No. So Tommy was the first person to get an actual job. He was in the mailroom at ITC Entertainment, which is home of The Prisoner and Thunderbirds and that kind of stuff. And he moved up and became a PA on a movie called The Last Seduction. And when he did that, it left a spot in the mailroom. So that was my very first entertainment job, was working in the mailroom at ITC. And I did that for an uncomfortably long amount of time. While we lived, there was like six of us that shared a house in Hollywood. And then I got a gig working for my friend David Sanger at a place called Digital Domain, which is Jim Cameron's visual effects company. And they were working on Terminator 2 3D, which was a ride for Universal Studios.
Oh.
And that was my first taste of like big budget movies.
Hmm.
And I stayed at Digital Domain for a little while and worked on Waterworld and Titanic.
What did you do?
I was a PA for some of it. I was post-production assistant for some of it. I was office coordinator for some. The Terminator project lasted almost 2 years, so I did like three or four different jobs over the course of that time. And then I moved to the purchasing department because I didn't have a lot of confidence in working freelance. Mm. And if I worked for the company, I'd had benefits and all that stuff. And I was like 25, and I was like, this is great. Like,
sure.
I'll just, you know, stay on here, work for purchasing.
Totally.
And then I worked on a bunch. I worked on Island of Dr. Moreau and Chain Reaction and Sergeant Bilko. And like, these are movies that none of these people that are listening are going to even know that actually happened. But these movies actually did happen. And like, I had my Hollywood experience. It was great. I worked with Jim Cameron. You know, I have a million stories from that. Like, John Frankenheimer walked into my office and just started talking one day. I met Michael Jackson. Like, I got to hug a tiger. Like,
why are there tigers in your office?
So they were doing the Island of Dr. Moreau, and they were shooting a motion capture test. So they put the little motion capture balls on a Bengal tiger that was heavily sedated, and they walked him around like an obstacle course in the back lot. And we were all hanging out there, and then the trainer was like, would you like to hug her? And I was like, yeah. And I got to hug the tiger. It was pretty great. And then there was an issue around me leaving the purchasing department to go back to work freelance, and I got let go. And
meaning you tried to arrange it in an open way, like,
yeah,
I'm going to go do some of this and some of that, and they were like, not so much?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, they do that sometimes.
Yeah, it was a shame. And that was on a movie called Dante's Peak, mm-hmm, that I went to go work freelance on, and that I got like through 2 weeks of that, and they were like, no, you can't do that. And then Titanic hired me on like secretly, and I went down to Mexico and did a couple of weeks on Titanic, and they found out, and there was a letter where I was declared persona non grata at Digital Domain, and anybody who hired me was going to be fired.
Why?
Because the woman that I worked for, whose name I will not mention,
sure,
in the purchasing department, was bitter over the fact that people kept coming through her department and then going on to do other things, and she got stuck there.
Sure.
And so she acted like it was cool for me to move on and work for the same company in a different capacity, but then she complained to the higher-ups that that was not the case, and that I didn't go through the correct channels and all that stuff. This is literally probably the most boring 10 minutes that you've ever done in one of these interviews.
No, you know what's interesting to me, when I talk to different people who have had different kind of paths, it's always interesting, you know, to hear certain things that you're going to deal with, right? Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure that this woman is not the only woman who has felt trapped in the level that she's landed at.
Absolutely.
And then sabotaged people who passed her along the way. There's a lot of that, especially in this particular industry where it's like, you can't, most people, and it kills me, but most people don't just enjoy the ride or like have a nice time in whatever job that they can do because they're working on a movie. They're mad they're not whatever number one thing that they think they deserve. And, you know, people that complain about what they deserve don't usually deserve it, honestly, I find in my experience. Where it's like, why haven't I been moved up? It's like, well, maybe why haven't you been moved up? Is it their problem or is it your problem?
Yeah.
But that happens a lot. And, you know, sometimes there are parts of the career where it's like, and by the way, people are going to do that. Like, people are going to stab you in the back because there's five positions for 40,000 people.
Right.
And they want it. And, you know, you were too nice.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know? And that's, it's interesting. It's interesting just, I think, personally, because it's like, you know, if you said, like, yeah, I didn't, you know, I skipped this step. Okay, I get it, why she's pissed. But if you're like, no, I talked to somebody and was like, hey, can I go do this other job? And they're like, sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And then one other lady's like, I don't like it. Well, what's going on with that? You know, I don't know. I think that every part of the process is important.
It is.
And it's going to happen to a listener.
Yeah, that's true.
In the world.
That's true.
If you're doing this, someone will be a jerk to you and steal your job.
Yeah.
That's going to happen in your life. Sorry.
No, it's totally true. And all I can say is at the moment that happens, it seems like you'll never be able to do the thing that you wanted to do. And that's there are a million ways to get to where you want to go.
Totally.
You know?
So as soon as you were kicked out on the curb,
well, there was a happened? Parallel path that was happening with this.
Interesting.
So at the same time, I was in the people that were in the production company formed a sketch comedy group called Players to Be Named Later.
What's it called again?
Players to Be Named Later.
Ah, of course.
And we fell into some good luck and ended up playing a place called the Upfront Theater in Santa Monica. Which was a place that there were a lot of really cool other troupes playing at the same time. House Full of Honkies played with us a whole lot, which was Wayne Brady and Jonathan Mangum's troupe. We played with Larson Masterson and Stiles a whole lot. So Ryan Stiles and his troupe was playing with us. They would have like, There was Second City in LA, but it didn't have a theater at the time. Mm-hmm. So they would have like the best of Second City in this theater on Thursday nights. So like you'd just show up and Dan Castellaneta would be doing sketch just there in front of like 10 people. So we hooked up with a guy named David Rosowski, who was the main stage director at Second City for a number of years.
Oh, yeah.
And he also was... His group at Second City was him, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, and a couple of other people like Nancy Walls and somebody else. It was like the most famous, like tiny group of Second City people. And Dave decided to move to LA. And there was a woman in our troupe named Mary Gallagher who knew him from Chicago. And she said, well, David would probably direct if we paid him like $10 a person.
Hmm.
And we were like, okay. So David took us on as like a project and was our director for like 3 years, every week. Before he was teaching in LA, he's like my mentor. He was our guy.
Hmm.
And he really took what was kind of raw about us and helped shape us into a professional unit, right? Like we really did very well. And we had a weird bent when it came to our sketches. We were sort of visceral, like we were kind of gory. It was like Grand Guignol sketch a little bit. And it culminated in a show that we did called Dr. Zhang's Hamper of Horrors, which was a an 8-week run that we did in Hollywood that sold out the entire run, where we ended the show by eviscerating somebody on stage. It's a long and complicated story, but that was sort of the height of our thing. And two of the guys in my troupe, Paul Hungerford and James Ferguson, were working with a gentleman named Javier Grillo Markswatch, who ended up being a producer for Lost, on pitching a film script. So they wanted to do a disaster movie. They wanted us to write this disaster movie.
Oh.
And it was called Flakes. And it was about a snowstorm in Los Angeles. It was a disaster movie about a run-of-the-mill snowstorm in Los Angeles. And so it was sort of like a vignette movie.
So wait, is this the sketch troupe that got this job to write this movie based on the work that you've done? Like, somebody saw your sketch show
and was like, yeah, go ahead.
Like, hey guys, we'd love you to write this disaster
movie.
It
wasn't like that. It was, I think James and Paul pitched the idea to Javi, and he was just like, yeah, write it up. Like, we'll see what happens, right? And they're pitching and pitching and pitching. They're pitching other stuff, too, at the same time. Mm-hmm. There was another guy in my troupe named Dean Noble who was also working at Universal. And, you know, we had all just begun to make ins into the entertainment industry, and everybody was kind of working our contacts wherever we could.
Sure.
And so Paul got to a point where he needed a bank account so that they could wire the first payment to us on what was going to be a $3 million budget. And we were like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, this is really happening. And that weekend, Brain Candy opened in the movie theaters and died. Hard.
Yeah.
And the people that were going to give us the money to make the movie thought, if Kids in the Hall can't do a sketch movie that works, nobody can do a sketch movie that works. And so that project died quickly, really quickly. And that sort of took the troupe down with it a little bit.
Oh.
And I mistakenly felt that some of my perceived failure in LA came due to my appearance.
Oh.
You know? Which turns out not to have been true, because stay tuned, folks, there's a redemptive LA story coming your way.
Ooh.
So, yeah, right? So after the break.
Man, I gotta add a break.
Right? should I go out and sell you some sponsors?
Man, for sure.
So yeah, I came, man, this is not about comedy at all. I feel like I'm telling my life story. This is super boring.
No, this is your journey. Plus, like, you were originally featured in the Austin Improv, episode.
Yeah.
You know, we're just getting to Austin. This is some good stuff.
It was around that time that Sean Hill was having auditions for what would become Austin Theater Sports. And so I missed the original audition because I was back in LA at a wedding. But I was desperate to do comedy again. And there didn't seem to be an entrance into the other comedy things that were happening in town, like Monk's Night Out or that kind of stuff. And so this was like, there was an ad in the Chronicle that was just like, if you have any comedy experience. And I was like, I do. And I hadn't improvised in a really long time, but I did. I did a little bit when I was in college. Dave taught some improv in LA when he stopped being our director and wanted to be an improv teacher. We all took his improv class for a while because he offered it to us at a discount.
Yeah.
And we had come at that point to realize that David Rosowski is one of the single greatest comedy minds on the face of the planet. So there are worse people to learn improv from.
Right.
So I felt like I could capably handle short form games, right?
Right.
So I called Sean.
Plus, I bet you'll rehearse.
Yes, that's what they say.
Yeah.
But how do you rehearse improv? So I called Sean and I was like, I can't make the audition. He's like, that's okay, come to callbacks. And I went to callbacks, and it was at this place that is affectionately called the Bat Cave. No longer exists. It was like 4th and I want to say just south of Congress, like San Jacinto or something. And it was this like crappy little office building that they would rent for like $8 an hour to do, you know, we all auditioned, and it was Sean ran the place and David Lampe was the artistic director. And in that callback was, myself, Craig Kotfuss, Shayna Merlin, Jeremy Sweetlam, Lauren Zinn, Edie Patterson, and a number of other people, but those are the people that I think...
Who's Who of Austin.
Yeah, those are the people I think you would probably know. And I made it, and it was great. It was so great. We rehearsed twice a week for like 4 months to get ready, and then Sean brought down Dan O'Connor and Brian Lohman to kind of run us through the first couple of shows. And because Sean knew them from Bats from Bay Area Improv.
Totally.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they came down and polished us up. We did our first Maestro and Gorilla that first night. I think Edie won them both. She, to this day, is one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. She's a fucking genius.
She's great.
She's
also been on this.
Yes, I know. And dear listener, as we speak, is the star of The Righteous Gemstones on HBO.
Yeah.
So Edie is just as great improvisationally as she is on camera. She's just ridiculously good. So we started playing at this place called, I think, the Public Something Theater on 6th Street. That was above, like next to where the residence is there, where the one person that lives on 6th Street is.
I don't know that.
There's one apartment on 6th Street.
I didn't know
that's just above Congress, 6th and Congress.
Okay.
Congress and like between 5th and 6th or 6th and 7th. And we did a show there. Somebody threw up on themselves in the very first night in the audience and they took focus from the entire show.
Sure.
And then we got a run at Hyde Park Theater and we did, I think, 4 months every Friday and Saturday. And it was just like 9 of us. And we did 2 shows a week, every week for 3 months with no audience.
So wait, with no audience?
I mean, there was like 2 or 3 people that would come to every show because there was no.
They gave you a run.
Yeah, because Ken Webster knew Sean. Ken Webster, by the way, I don't know how many people have sort of name checked some of the great behind the scenes people in the Austin comedy scene.
No, tell me.
But Ken Webster is one of them. He's always been a tremendous supporter of improv and sketch in Austin. Like, offered up Hyde Park for us to play, and we used to rent it when we did it. I had another sketch troupe here that we rented from, and putting us all in the Frontera Fest every year and that kind of stuff. And then people like Robert Ferris and Wayne Allen Brenner would not be if it weren't for their support. Seriously, when we first started doing stuff, we couldn't even get into the Chronicle. We would try really, really, really hard every week to submit something, and we wouldn't even get a listing. I remember we got like halfway through the Hyde Park run, I think we got a listing, like, this is happening this week, and we were like thrilled. We've made it, you know? So we did that run, and it was around that time that Sean was looking for a place to buy, and he bought this little pawn shop next to a Wendy's at 7th and Congress, and was like, I'm going to turn this into a theater and a coffee house, because he desperately wanted the theater. And I think he really thought that coffee house, because Starbucks was so popular. Sean doesn't drink coffee. He'd never drank coffee in his life. had never tasted coffee before he opened the Hideout. So it was around that time that Big Stinkin' 3 happened, and Theater Sports got into Big Stinkin' 3, and we got to play 2 shows there. And
so Big Stinkin's happening. The town is sort of got the beginnings of Austin's comedy scene happening. I mean, Big Stinkin' was a big deal.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that's
happening.
It wasn't
and
the beginning.
You guys
it was sort of the end of the first big Austin comedy scene, right? So
right.
Big Stinkin' 3 was, I think there was a fourth one, but 3 was like the pinnacle, right? It was exactly South By, but for comedy. There were like 10 venues.
Moon Tower wishes it could be?
Yeah. But yeah, it was. But the vibe was cool, right? Like Moon Tower, people don't go hang out a lot at Moon Tower. This was like, this was a place where, because there were only a couple of comedy festivals in the country at the time, right? Yeah. There was Chicago, and there was, and not even in the country, there was Montreal. And that was pretty much it. There was nothing really in New York. There was nothing in LA. So there were these couple big things. And then Big Stinkin' was a place where people would come. People had gotten discovered here. Alex Borstein was in one of the
Family Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was in one of the first Big Stinkin's. She kind of got discovered here. The King of the Hill cast did a barbecue. Like, it was a big deal. And it was so much fun. And it was like Burning Man for comedy for me, right? Like, I showed up and I was like, okay, what are we doing for the next 8 days? I'm going to just give me as much of this as I possibly can take.
Yeah.
And we met all these great people that I'm still friends with from all over the country. And I thought, like, this is the way to do a festival. This is really awesome, right? So we got into that. We had a couple really decent shows. And then LA Theater Sports and Impro Theater, which are the same group, came out at the same time. And that was Dan. But also they came out with Wayne Brady and the Honkies did a show. And it was cool for me because I kind of knew some of those people and they were kind of getting famous. And it was like, oh, I get to use a little of my LA juice on this experience, right? Like, And that was around the time that everybody was like, we're going to destroy this city. We're gonna do the best that we can. But we were still not drawing very well. The shows would only make about 70% of the time. The other 30% of the time we had to go out and send the audience home. And we were doing a lot of stuff, just the like 8 or 9 of us. And to his credit, Sean signed us up for every promotional opportunity that there was, right? Like we did a show at Bass Concert Hall. That was, I think, like an orientation thing where we did Mousetrap on stage for 1,500 people, which was really fun.
Wow.
We did the Mardi Gras festival on 6th Street where they closed 6th Street and we opened for Cowboy Mouth. We did like 10 minutes before they did. We did the Head in the Bucket thing. And Shayna Merlin got hit in the head by a full beer that somebody threw at her from the crowd. And she just kept going. She like grabbed it out of the sky and kept going. It was fun times, but tough times too. Like we weren't getting a lot of people. And Sean decided that he needed to start a school to really be able to make a career out of improv. Like, it wasn't just going to be a troupe that was going to make the money.
Sure.
So we had auditions to give us some relief, so it wasn't the same 9 people doing everything, right? And out of those auditions came Shannon McCormick, who I became instantly super close with. And I'm trying to think of who else was in that second wave. People like Mo Davio and Bob Apthorpe and Peter Rogers, they were in that second group, that second wave of people. Then it got to be, we had like a JV team, so we could take a little bit of a break, but we still weren't drawn all that well. And Sean appointed Shayna to sort of run the theater so that he could run the coffee house. And the scene was very good and starting to kind of bubble up, and people from those underclasses were forming troops in different configurations, right? It was around that time that so Fat Buckle came around, and that was the student troupe from St. Ed's, which Lietti was in. And they had sort of a friendly competition with the jury, who were the UT kids. And then the group that was underneath all of the jury when they were in high school was a group called Yumi and Greg. And they were friends with Casey Beeler, who at the time was like 15. And started hanging around and doing improv with them. And then Shannon ran a thing on midnights on Friday called No Shame Theater where you could do anything, literally anything. So artists from all over town would come and just sign up for these slots and just do bizarre performance art. And that's where we met Lubu, Brian Roberts from. And then, and Courtney Hopkin. Courtney hung out with, Courtney was, there was a, do you know about Rat Girl? Have you ever heard about Rat Girl? One of the greatest performance artists in the history of Austin was this woman named Stephanie Towery, who played a character called Rat Girl, who would dress up as an adult rat and spoke in a sort of pidgin English that was rat, like patter, and show up at every like show in town and like critique it loudly from the audience. Not heckle, but like critique. And then she would do shows of her own, and Courtney Hopkin was what they called Jobber Rat Girl. She was like Rat Girl's assistant. And they just did things all over town. They just would show up at every weird art thing with the Rat Girls. And they were a big part of the No Shame thing. And then Michael Joplin had the Blue High Machine Mid-Southern Wrestling Coalition, which was a parody of backyard of like old NWA wrestling that we all did. Like we were part of that. So there was a time period when the wrestlers would run in on improv shows and give people chair shots, or we put Ace through a table and just leave. All of this stuff sort of blended together. And then Jeremy decided they had been out, the jury had done some shows out of town, and they decided they wanted to do a festival. And I was living with Craig and Jeremy at the time. And we had been playing a lot of Tiger Woods golf on PlayStation 2. Like a lot. When we weren't doing comedy, we were doing that. And so there had been a lot of golf motif in our house at the time. And he at some point came to me and said, what would you do with people at a comedy festival that was something that they could all do together that was not going to a bar? And I said, you should have a miniature golf tournament. That's like the Masters. And so that's sort of where Out of Bounds came from. There's also, as part of the Tiger Woods thing, there was this weird animation when you'd hit a ball out of bounds, the camera would just push in on you. It was very sad. Like your character would just look super sad and it would just say out of bounds. And we just thought that was really funny. So it stuck. And that first year, the jury hosted, there was like six troops. We all walked through campus selling ads in the program for like $10 a piece to try and pay for the thing. I do not think there was a shirt the first year. Jeremy and I began our long-standing tradition of folding programs the night before the show, the first show, that went all the way up until about Out of Bounds 15. And it started from there, and then they went to Chicago and became the Available Cup holders. And I had met the woman that would be my first wife. So, I decided to stay in Austin. And, so Jeremy said to me and Shannon, if you guys want the festival, you can have it. So we were like, great, we'll take it. So year 3, 4, and 5 was me and Shannon. We executive produced it. I think year 2, it had grown to maybe 8 troops. And then I think in our third year, Shannon and I were like, let's just blow it out. And we ended up with 20. And that's when it got multi-theaters, multi-stages, those couple years. And then the third year,
do you know what years that was?
It would have been 4, 5, and 6, 2004, 2005, 2006, because I left in the middle of producing my third year to go back to LA. But also in 2004, because Gravy had left, Craig Coffis and I were looking for something to do, for a troupe to do. And do you know Aaron Sines? Mm-mm. So Aaron was one of the jury. He's a Hideout performer now. He went to college in Boston. He went to Harvard. And when he was done, he moved back here with a young gentleman named David Modigliani, who is the grandson of Modigliani, the painter. Dave had done improv in Boston and was like, came back here and was like, I want to do improv, but I don't want to do like theater sports or anything like that. Like, I want to start a troupe. So he and Craig and I started to think about putting a troupe together, and we were just getting ready to do our first ever rehearsal in October of 2004. And David is an enormous Red Sox fan, and it was the American League Championship Series with the Red Sox and the Yankees, where they were down 3-0 and came back to win the whole thing. And it was the game four where they were going to get eliminated, and Tim Wakefield was pitching, and Tim Wakefield was well known for his knuckleball. And so we watched that game, and it was this huge momentum shift, and we all felt super good about the world and what we were doing and all that kind of stuff. And we decided to put together a list of names for a troupe. And we all, the only thing that we all came back with that had, that was in common, was the concept of the knuckleball. And so we, you know, we were the knuckleballers, or, you know, just the knuckleball or knuckleball. And we came up with the knuckleball now because it had dual meanings. It was throw the knuckleball now, right? Like, you're calling for it as a pitch. And also the time period we were in was super bizarre because Bush had been reelected and nobody knew what was going on. So it seemed like a knuckleball now that we were living in. Yeah. And we were sort of down with that. And we added a guy named Mike Dolan, and that was the first, we played Waffle Fest that year, and that was the first iteration of Knuckleball Now. And that went with me in it for another year and a half. I got offered a gig to go back to LA, to go work for a network called G4. That was a video game television.
Oh yeah, G4. This is the redemptive arc that we've been waiting for. Yes. I'm so excited.
For all this time, I know. I feel so boring.
No, I'm just excited to find out what happened.
So a good friend of mine from high school worked at G4 and called me and said, we just fired our entire digital staff. And they're looking for somebody to be a web producer for this show called X-Play. X-Play was the hardcore video game show, but it was video games and comedy. They wanted somebody who knew both video games and comedy, and I did. And so I went and interviewed for that gig, and 5 weeks later I got offered, and I moved back to LA in 2006. So we go back, and I got this gig, and it was super great, and I didn't do improv again for like 3 years, two years maybe. And then Jeremy moved out to LA because he wanted to give it a shot. And we did Out of Bounds West for 2 years in Los Angeles, which was fantastic. We did it at a place called the West Side Eclectic Theater, which is still there. We did two nights with about 16 troops. It was super successful, in by which I mean we didn't lose any money. Hmm. And we got a chance to play, and all of our troops from here came out there and we played with them, and that was super fun. And then he and I and Edie and Dan started a troupe called Hello that played together for a little while. And that was really fun. And we'd have guests like Steve Kieran play with us, or you know, Brian Lohman played with us, and that was really fun. But Edie was starting to get busy. Like, it was around that time that she started to book things a lot. And so we didn't always have access. So the four of us would almost never play together, but we rehearsed together, and that was really fun.
What kind of troupe was it? Like, what kind of improv were you doing? Because it wasn't comedy sports, right?
No, we were doing long form at that point. Okay. We were doing non-genre long form. So it was sort of like montage-y with a theme, right? Mm-hmm.
Knuckleball Now was the beginning of the departure from the theater sports.
Right? Actually, Gravy was the beginning of the departure from theater sports.
Oh, okay. So, was there someone to teach you these other forms, or were you reading books and figuring them out?
We were reading books. We were figuring them out. Jeremy and the jury had departed a long time ago, so he sort of brought that knowledge with him where he went. I think Shannon was doing Get Up by that point with Shayna for a little while, and so they had already started, and we had seen a bunch of different formats. And also, the stuff at the Hideout had evolved to where it wasn't always just Gorilla and Maestro on theater sports. There was a little bit longer form. They had a thing called 6 Degrees, which was kind of a long form setup, but they hadn't gotten into any genre yet. The first genre they did at the Hideout was Star Trek, which was probably around 2004.
I just wondered because I know that Dan and Edie do a lot of the improvised plays now.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wondered if you guys in Hello were doing improvised
plays. No, we were just doing long-form stories. Yeah. It was before Impro had started to do exclusively improvised plays, right? Dan and Edie and Impro started off as theater sports. They were LA theater sports.
Right.
So they would do longer form stuff, and they did genre stuff occasionally, but they didn't always do that. But now they do.
So in the G4 incarnation of your trip to Los Angeles, mm-hmm. you went and you had friends there. So
I did.
It wasn't like as lonely.
No,
or
it
as,
wasn't
like,
lonely. I was married.
Right, you're married. Yeah. You're going. You've got a bunch of friends
yep.
there already. So, it makes a lot more sense why this second time would be a lot easier.
Yeah, the job was great. G4 was awesome. It was improv for work, basically, because we did sketches on air, and I got to help, like, write that stuff, and then we did some of it online. I was working on the digital team, and we got to shoot stuff, and, I learned about the inner workings of television and how that works, and it was super fun. And I kind of shot up the totem pole there. I worked really hard I got to be creative director of the website after a while, which was cool.
How many years did you work there?
I worked at G4 from 2006 to 2012.
Oh.
And then it became the Esquire network. And so I stayed on at Esquire until 2015. And then Esquire dissolved, and I worked for E, which was the same company. NBC owned the whole thing. So I worked for E, and then I worked for the Comcast Entertainment Group, which was basically doing interstitial videos for all of their USA, Sci-Fi, E, Bravo, Oxygen.
It's crazy how many of the television stations are all owned by one company.
Yeah, yeah. It's
like,
a lot.
Wait.
Yeah, you're watching all the same thing pretty
yeah.
much.
And all the same like commercial setups and yeah. things like that.
Yeah.
Like
oof. But that was I got to use a lot
That's
of
wild.
my creative my comedy stuff doing that stuff too. Which
so we
really
just
fun.
we like jumped over like a bunch of years mm-hmm. as a television producer.
Yeah, yeah.
Like so they're just giving you carte blanche to make interstitial videos between the programming and
yeah,
you're
sort of.
Working
well,
for...
So I was. We were doing the website, which it was around the time that they determined that you could do video on websites. Like that's
right.
2006.
Digital
was,
presence
yeah,
is a
yeah.
lot more of a thing.
So we had a blog that was doing 16 million unique viewers a month. And we had the ability to do these sort of comedy videos and related to gaming videos, and then like I said, X-Play, which was the show that I was the producer for, did a lot of those sketches on air, and I got to act in some of them, and I got to contribute a lot in that way, and it was very very writer's roomy, you know, and some of the people there turned out to do other stuff too. There's a guy named Guy Branum who was one of the writers there who ended up having a show called Talk Show the Game Show. Hmm. That he was the host of and the executive producer of, with Casey Schreiner, who was another writer there who was on Attack of the Show. And it was just a super creative experience. that was a unique bubble in the world of television, because we weren't getting any ratings at all. But at the time, nobody cared. No, it's not that nobody cared, but they were just like, yeah, go do, right? The giant...
The G4 was a big deal for a while.
It was okay. I mean, the ratings never were that good, but it was culturally impactful for a little while.
It was culturally impactful. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like a lot of the people who were, like, hosts on certain shows have moved on. Mm-hmm. Now they're, like, big-name actors. Yeah. So it's like, you know, say what you will. It's like MTV. You know, you got any job at MTV, you're doing all right.
Yeah. Like, and I really felt like I had made my peace with LA, right? The second time around was a much better experience. I was far more sure of myself, and I knew who I was, and all of that was because of the time I spent here. All of it. Because I probably did 10,000 hours of improv in Austin before I left. Like, just constant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I got pretty sure of my ability and my personality and my standing in a cultural sense and my talent. And I, you know, was bound and determined. One of the great things about leaving LA the first time was realizing that not everything in the world happens there. I'm sure you probably had the same experience in New York, right? Like, when you move out of New York, you're like, oh, there's places other than New York where things are happening and people are happy.
Yeah. Well, New York doesn't want you to know that.
Right. Neither does LA. Right. Right? And so when I left
and
came here.
That's why they have New York Magazine.
Right. Yeah.
It's just about how cool it is to live in New York.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love it. I'd like to get it now.
Yeah. It's pretty good. It's pretty good magazine, right? But I was happy here and I knew that I could be happy somewhere else. That I didn't have to make my life in LA. Right, that was just an option that I was taking.
But you had been there for so many years. Like,
yeah.
You're going on like 9-10 years at this point.
Yeah, yeah. So so I actually stayed all the way through January of 2018.
Hmm. So you just got back.
Yeah, a year and a half ago.
Wow.
So, and then I started improvising again. And so
in LA.
Yeah. And so I went to, ironically enough, Impro decided that they were going to start doing theater sports again. Hmm. And my old friend, Paul Hungerford, who was in the first half of the LA story, was running that experience and was like, you should come and audition. And I was like, okay. So I did. And, it was super low impact, right? I didn't want to do the, I didn't want to have to leave this experience the first time and go to a place and start at level one again. Like, I didn't want to have to go through a school to get on stage, you know?
I've heard that before.
When I got back to LA, I went to a show at, Acme.
Was that somewhere that's probably not there?
It's there, but not really there anymore. But Acme was a good house. Like, Fred Willard played there on Friday nights, every Friday night.
Yeah, it's just LA improv is kind of having a renaissance. Yeah. Where, like, a lot of the older places are leaving and a lot of the newer, there's a lot new coming in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Especially, like, even with Impro being, like, super focused on, like, improvised plays, it also, like, you know, the landscape of it is changing.
Although they have the lab, which does other stuff, which is kind of great, you know?
There's a lot that do more than just your average montage.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, like with I.O. gone, yeah. and there were a couple other spots. That's why I, like, made the joke about, like, Acme going away, because, like, half the other places.
Yeah.
Like, certain comedy beginning spots, things like the Nerd Melt gone.
Yeah, like, which is a shame.
Sure.
Nerd Melt was great.
Yeah.
Jonah Ray is a friend of mine from G4.
So G4.
Right. So I knew all, like, Kamel used to come on and host Attack of the Show. Like, all those guys would rotate through at one point or another before Nerd Melt really happened. So when it did, it was like, oh, those guys. Oh, now they're, like, those guys, right?
Can I ask a question about the G4 time?
Yeah.
So, like, you want to be... Clearly, you've put most of the effort of your life into being a sketch writer.
Right.
Like, you're a sketch comedian. This is what you want to do.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel in this? I'm going to use the word square, but I don't mean it that way.
That's okay.
I just mean it like it's a job that has. You mentioned earlier that that's something that you're into, like the stability.
Yeah.
So I just wondered, like, you seem to be getting the sketch comedy part out of this job, but like, how are you handling having to do all the other, I'm assuming, bureaucratic things?
So
to work at like a television network.
Yeah. So it got to the point where I got into. Strangely enough, for an artist, I'm also a process person. Like, my job is coming up with processes. Right.
Sure.
So I streamlined all of the stuff that they wanted me to do and eventually became the supervisor of people that was doing those things and got to kind of not be in the weeds on a daily basis and go do more of the things that I wanted to do.
Right.
Right. Until being creative director was all of the things I wanted to do. And the only thing that kept that from sticking around was that the network folded. Right. I didn't get to write comedy all the time, but I got to write enough that I felt like it was an interesting part of my job. And also, Jeremy worked there with me. I hired Jeremy. So he worked at G4 for like a year, and that was super fun. Like, we got to do some other stuff on the side. We got to use all their equipment to make films and stuff, and that was really good. He did a lip sync video to El Final de Camino, which is End of the Road in Spanish, Boys to Men, that we put on YouTube, and it got discovered by Boys to Men and is now in their Las Vegas show. Like, the actual, our lip sync video is a part of a montage in their show.
Wow.
Like, people would write me from Vegas all the time and be like, I just saw you in the Boys to Men show.
You're like, yeah, they like us.
Yeah, they just bought it from us.
We were like, I guess.
Yeah, whatever.
Boys to men.
Now I'm just a man to man.
Man to man.
Man to man.
That's a different kind of, that's a Craigslist.
It's a whole other show. Yeah. That's what used to be at Riverside. And
I was like, you know what? Craigslist doesn't even do that anymore.
I don't think they do that.
No, they, like, literally, like, last year they dropped dating.
Man. What do you do on Craigslist now? Furniture?
I don't think a lot of people were dating for a long time. I mean, I dated on it for
sure. On Craigslist?
100%.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How did that go?
I don't know. I don't know how to judge my dating life compared to the world. It's not a romantic comedy movie by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
But I'm not murdered. Look at me. I'm not dead.
Because I did... I met both of my wives through dating sites.
So now you're in Los Angeles
yes.
with your second wife,
yes.
who you met on OkCupid.
That's correct.
And your career is going great. Why did you move away?
People kept getting laid off, right? So
G4
went under,
mm-hmm.
and it became Esquire Network.
Right.
And I stayed at Esquire Network.
Esquire, the...
Television network. Yeah,
the
magazine.
But like the magazine.
Yeah,
okay.
It's based on the magazine.
And strangely enough, that was... True Hollywood Story,
yes,
that was you?
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. So Esquire Network was really fun, too, in a completely different way, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was in my 40s. It was the kind of magazine that I would read.
Sure.
I was on the craft cocktail beat, which was super fun. I got to go out and, like, shoot promos on the Bourbon Trail in Kentucky. And, like, I used to go on trips to, like, let's go to Martinez, California and document the history of the martini. Let's go to, you know, New Orleans and discover the Sazerac. Like, super fun, right?
Yeah.
And then that went away.
Sure.
And so then I got kind of offloaded to E and then to Comcast Entertainment Group. And at that point, I was on call 24/7.
As a what?
As a producer. So I would just shoot.
Make whatever?
So, like, I'd shoot a commercial. Let's say it was, here's a perfect example. I went to New York for Fashion Week. Not really my jam as an event, but it turned out to be kind of fun because
yeah,
it's something I never thought
fun.
I'd have a chance to do, right? So we would shoot for a major shampoo company. Some social influencers talking about the shampoo is here at, you know, whatever. And I had to deliver it, shot and edited the day after it happened.
Whew.
So I would shoot in New York, send the footage to Los Angeles, wait overnight, get the footage in the middle of the night, give it to the client in New York for notes, send it back to Los Angeles to finish, send it back to New York for notes, send it back to Los Angeles to finish, and deliver the next day and shoot the second piece. And that sort of thing happened to me all the time. Like when I was at Esquire, it was one project at a time because it was one network. So I didn't have to worry about dealing with multiple things. It just got so stressful. And my wife and I adopted a baby. And as you know, the first 6 months of having a child are hellish in a lot of ways.
They're crazy.
And mixing those two things together was starting to really wear on me in a big way. And my wife sort of casually floated one day, like, you wouldn't want to move back to Austin, would you? And I was like, yes. As a matter of fact, I would love to move back to Austin because we were living, we were, even though I had a great career, I was living in a 950 square foot apartment that was $2,225 a month. And I had a baby living in my office in that apartment that soon was going to outgrow that apartment. And I had no idea what we were going to do as far as space went. And the idea of slowing down a little bit and enjoying being a parent in my 40s really appealed to me. And I missed my friends, you know? And some of my friends here have kids that are close to my son's age. And I thought it would be much more fun to raise him around them. So I started to really, like, I had a, I would have recurrent dreams about barbecuing chicken. And the reason was because chicken is like my fifth favorite thing to barbecue.
Fifth.
And in my mind, it was because I had been doing this long enough that I had gone through the first four things and I got to chicken. Like, I was that comfortable. You know what I mean? Like, this was not just a one-off deal. This was my life.
So barbecue chicken is your career at this point.
Yeah.
This is how you feel.
Yeah.
When your dreams are telling you
to go slow down.
Because barbecue chicken sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. And so
it's like, what's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah. Turn the grill off.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, we're done. It's just chicken. You put it in a microwave. Yeah, it's fine.
It's in the microwave.
No, you'll die. Trichinosis. And so I started to sort of obsess on the idea of coming back to Austin and, you know, being able to buy a house at some point. You know, I was working really hard and making what under normal circumstances would seem like a lot of money and still living paycheck to paycheck.
It's only because you came from LA that the idea of moving to Austin meant you could buy a house.
Oh,
in my life, like the idea of buying a house in Austin is like, no way.
Oh.
Never going to happen. I'm not a millionaire.
No. We came here and you were like, you could still buy a house for $350,000 here?
No, that's true.
You know?
Yeah.
It just wasn't happening there. It just, you'd have to, the enormity of what would have to happen for you to be able to do that. I would have had to kill myself to continue to make that money. And I was just so stressed and I didn't, you know, just didn't like it anymore. After I left Comcast and I worked at Entertainment Tonight for a year. And there were aspects of that I liked, but again, I was on call 24/7 because entertainment news is still news. And when it's breaking in the middle of the night, you have to show up to work. Oddly enough, I work in the news here. And it is breaking and I'm still on call, but not nearly as much as I used to be.
Well, also you get the other benefits that you were looking for.
Yeah. And so,
you know,
so kind of tying the comedy thing back, I was very lucky to have Knuckleball offer me the opportunity to come back. Like, no questions asked.
When I moved back to town,
which was fantastic. Because in the time that I've been gone, they became really successful and popular, and everybody really loves them. And now I get to kind of step into that and just sort of like reap their benefits. Although that took me a little while to become comfortable in that. I was around the same time that I got here, Michael Joplin left. And replacing Joplin is an incredibly difficult task. He's just unbelievably talented and super great. It's not replacing him, but like
yeah, I was like, that's not really how improv works.
No, but like for a troupe that people are kind of familiar with that only has four or five people in it for 15 years, that got sort of popular, I'm the new guy. But yeah, I got lucky to be able to come back into that and do that work with them, which is just the best. It's the perfect troupe to be in, you know. I've never been so. I tend to treat all of my comedy troupes like family. We like check on each other on Tuesdays to tell each other that we love each other. It's just weird, you know.
Yeah.
That was really nice. Actually, sort of another pivotal thing in the coming back experience was I did the marathon a couple years ago when I was still in LA. I came back and did the 46-hour marathon.
Oh, like you were one of the marathoners.
Yeah. Andy Crouch had been asking me every year if I wanted to do it. And every year I had something to do. Or I was going to fly back for out of bounds, so I couldn't do them both at the same time. And then just one year I was like, yeah, I want to do it. And I was terrified because I was 45 and I'd never...
That'll be about when I do it.
Yeah. it's life-changing awesome, yeah. You know? I got a chance to do, you know, 35 different genres in 1 2-day experience, you know, which was great. The other seven, well, actually the other eight people that, because Tosin was our musician, and he stayed and played with us for the entire time. So the other eight people, we still talk to each other all the time. It was a really special group of people, and it made me feel like, oh, I could fit in Austin again if I moved back. And I was really into that idea. And it also was like, oh, I can do this. Like I felt like a ninja at the end of it. You know, like you could throw me any format and I can.
Oh yeah.
Kind of do it.
48 hours.
Yeah. It's a lot.
It's crazy. So since you have, when you moved back, you were easily able to get a job in the industry again. Like,
no, yeah, fairly easily. Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, you've just, once you learned how to play the game and like get the jobs in the industry, you're able to, you know, craft a resume and hit the interviews properly? Is it just time? Like, 'cause I wonder for people that are like, yeah, I could do that. Like, how do you get into it without, you know, because the work that you're doing sounds like, you know, good, valid work for people who are like, want to do, you know, who got a theater degree or did something. Sure. Like, how do you frame yourself? Because, like, I know for me, when I got an agent, I realized when I got the agent, I didn't even know what an acting resume was supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. They took my resume and they were like, no, here's how you are supposed to do it correctly. And I was like, I had no idea. Like, how would a person who's interested in doing what you do even start to get into it?
Well, so I would say the very first thing is to realize that it's not all going to happen at once, right?
There's
there's no magic bullet that's going to just be like, hey, you're a director tomorrow, right?
Right.
So you have to be willing to put in the time, and you have to be willing to spend a number of years grinding it out, you know what I mean? Like just doing stuff because you like it and not because it's, you have to redefine what success looks like for you, right? If it's money, then there's a path to that that doesn't necessarily involve artistic joy or freedom, right? If it's artistic freedom, then doesn't necessarily involve money. I would say you have to get to know people. You know, the first time I was in LA, I was terrible at schmoozing people. And I think if you put it that way, nobody wants to do that. It sounds awful,
yeah.
Right? But go to the places that people are doing things that you want to do and offer yourself up in some small way, you know? Intern if you can. Volunteer if you can. If you want to do, I don't know, let's say you wanted to do comedy, always be at shows, right? Make it so that everybody knows who you are. Take classes, you know, join up with other people who want to do what you do and just do as much of it as you can for free, right? That doesn't sound like a fun way to get a job, but it's giving you experience. You
know? Not to mention the fact that in these days, there are so many people that are making, you know, tiny films in their backyard that, yeah, like, you know, they've got six of them to show when they get a chance to get the job. If you don't, well, yeah, then you're behind.
I mean, my next step is Shannon McCormick and I have a production company that we put together that has started off with what we call the Free Range Writers Room. So we found eight people that were interested in getting together and pitch projects of all stripes, whether it's we're doing narrative podcast, we're doing television, we're doing animated series, we're doing Twitch style gaming, that kind of stuff. And then everybody pitched a project and we worked on them in order, and we're now at five pilots after 9 months. And then Shannon and I are going to use our industry connections to try and push those things to see how we can get them made. And if we can't, we'll just make them. And as much as it feels like that is sort of ground zero, that's somehow how you have to get things done. Like if you can't find somebody to do it for you, you have to do it yourself. Man, that doesn't sound like good advice.
No, it is. I mean, realistically, in a lot of jobs, especially where there's a creative element or making TV or movies these days, there's a lot of like, okay, go get it done.
Yeah.
Like, it's very rarely like, let me hold your hand through this process and explain to you what to do. I mean, even people who are coming from like film schools and stuff, they're expecting you to know what you're doing.
Right. I mean, I would say this too. Don't feel like you have to know everything right off the bat, right? Don't be afraid to ask people about the stuff that you don't know how to do. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're like trying to find, you know, just like trying to find treasure with a flashlight and nothing else, you know?
Right.
People do this stuff, and people like me, like I joined the mentor program for Emerson because I want to be able to tell people what I do. And I think people that have worked really hard, as almost everybody does, to get to a certain spot in the entertainment industry, want to be able to pass that stuff along, because almost everybody that gets to a certain point is kind of cool about it. And not, you know, there's this sort of trope that people, executives and stuff, are assholes. Like, that you get to a certain point and it's like, ah, get out of my office, I don't want to know anything about you. And it's like, no, they're all really super helpful, right? Like, if you come to them looking for knowledge, they will give you all that you can handle, you know? This was when we were doing Players Be Named Later and kind of getting successful but not really knowing, I sort of developed this idea that this particular industry is one in which there are very few signs that tell you that you're doing the right thing, right? You go a really, really, really long time in one direction and not know if you're headed in the right direction.
Right.
So learn to look for the signs, no matter how small that they are, that you're, even if it's like success 1,000 miles, at least you know you're headed in the direction of success.
Right.
You know? And learn to recognize them for what they are, right?
I feel like mine's usually like I'm driving down the road and it says like, now leaving success. I'm like, wait, oh, okay, great. I guess that was, okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I, from an outsider's perspective, I would look at this and say, you've done what, 177 of these or what?
Yeah, it'll be about, about the number of years. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the work itself is successful.
Oh, sure.
I mean, think of the first couple that you did and how probably you had very little you knew about what you were doing in terms of like you know, editing it together and crafting a story and making sure all that stuff worked. And
you know, I'm more of a do the work kind of person than I am worrying about success. Like, you know, success sounds cool, I guess, you know, and also like success has different levels. You know what I mean? There are different points of my life where I've been doing exactly what I wanted to do, you know, and there's just ups and downs to that. So for me, consistency is my thing. I just keep doing something and maybe it's great and maybe it's not, but I keep doing it for way longer than I mean, I did the neighborhood sketch show for 8 years.
Wow.
I mean, that was a lot of shows.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, very different. And I was the only variable that was the same in every single one.
Yeah.
It was crazy. But, you know.
Was it fun?
You learn stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But it wasn't always fun, right?
No, it was terrible sometimes.
So, and that's the, I hate that, like, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Well, fuck that. You work. Even if you love it, it's still work sometimes, right?
I think people don't like to accept the ambrosia that is life, which is that, like, yeah, you can do what you want, but you're also going to, like, be doing it while eating a shit sandwich.
Right.
Like, this is what's going to happen. You're not getting... when in your life has it ever been one thing? Like, no, it's 400 things. Yeah. And, like, how do you feel about juggling these particular 400 things? Because this is what you have right now. And in 2 weeks, it's going to be a totally different situation.
Yeah. And so I think that's another thing is that you have to manage against your own lack of enthusiasm, right?
Yes.
Because something that seems super exciting when you first start to do it, after a couple months and you're like, oh, no, this is a job. Oh, I'm tricked. This is a job, you know? Then you have to be like, oh, do I still like this job? And some people panic at that point. Like, oh, this is not what I wanted to be. I'll just be a banker, you know, or I'll just go.
Yeah, but everything's that way.
It is. It is totally that way. Right.
Yeah.
So I would say, like, even though entertainment is really fun and I have, you know, thank God I don't have to do anything like difficult, you know, that's not what I mean. I don't have to dig ditches for a living.
You
know,
it's not your job to be one of those guys that's out in the heat all day,
right?
Building all the new hotels,
right? And
I always feel so bad for them.
I do too. And but sometimes you have to remind yourself that, like, life is long, and some of the long parts are long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you know, it's not always great. Not every day is a party. You know, you have to be able to look back on it and go, oh, I get a chance to do that. That was cool, and try to really appreciate the cool stuff when it happens. That's what those signposts are about, you know? And recognize that you're getting better at your craft all the time. And it is a craft. And that there is some, in my mind, especially with the comedy stuff, there is some great book of comedy that exists in the universe somewhere, right?
I think there's about 50, but okay.
Well, no, I mean like a celestial book, like the titans are up in the skies with this enormous book of the craft of comedy. And if I am able to contribute to half a sentence in that book that lives eternally, then I will have done everything that I could possibly have done. You know what I mean?
I feel like, I mean, you're in a Boys to Men, like,
and
concert.
That's the most important thing.
That's the most important thing, I think, period, end of sentence.
Yeah.
That's Boys to Men touring in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I'm there.
30 years after their peak.
Yeah.
It's key.
You know, I missed my own signpost, I think.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I saw Styx with one member in it. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Las Vegas is, you know, a
no,
wild
no,
place.
No, I get it.
I'm glad to talk to you about, because I think you've come at creative careers in a different way than other people. And I appreciate hearing about it because, you know, it seems more, again, I'm going to use a negative phrase.
Square.
Straight.
Yeah.
Well, I use square and now I use straight. Neither great. But, you know, it's like it makes so much sense, but it's great that you're able to do it and, like, find ways to enjoy it along the way, because, you know, who knows, the slog of TV producing might not be always so exciting.
No, it's not. No, it's not. But it can be fulfilling, right? Like, I work in local news now. So I'm an executive producer for digital for local news, which has very little to do with entertainment. It's just news.
Great.
But, you know, I get to cover some stories that, like, my friends are making news. So I get to be like, hey, Out of Bounds is happening. Let's have them on the news this morning, you know?
Or yeah.
Like, and that is my little contribution to what's going on. And I feel like I'm in some way in the community and, like, I don't want to say making a difference because that's gross.
I mean, you're performing, like, and
yeah,
you've reconnected. The production company sounds like a great resource to
and that's where I think we're really
creative headed. People in town, and also, like, work on your own projects. Like, just being able to do that and use the skills that you've learned over these years is great.
Yeah.
I mean, you can come in, and there are people like me, for instance, who are like, yeah, I'd like to do stuff, but I don't have clue one where to begin how to do something like that. And you know, at least how to get in a door and what to say. You know, that stuff is important.
Yeah, so the one last piece of advice I would give to anybody in terms of, like, what to say or what to do or whatever is probably the most functional piece of advice I've ever gotten in my entire life is the worst thing that can happen to you in any given situation is you get shot in the face.
I'm sorry. Right?
Because anything else is a victory, right? Like, you just, well, I didn't get shot in the face. The learnings from improv are more than just things that you learn on stage, right? Fail spectacularly. Because why not? If you get to pitch something to somebody, you only get one chance to pitch it to them. Just fucking pitch it, right? Like, you know, don't hold back. Don't try to be cool. Don't worry about what they think of you as a human being. If you believe in this thing and you think they're going to buy it, they're either going to buy it or they're not. It has nothing to do with, like, what you wore that day, or, like, whether or not you, like, made them laugh in the presentation, apart from what the piece is, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I take pitches all the time. I hire people all the time. I audition people all the time. Like, be yourself and don't be afraid to just kind of lay it out there, you know, because if I'm not going to hire you, it's not because I didn't like you as a person. It's just because I didn't like you for this thing, you know? I might call you later.
And there's so many other variables.
Yeah. Yeah. I might go like, oh, you know, that woman Amy came in and did this really cool audition for this piece that she was completely not right for, but now I'm writing this thing and I can't get that audition out of my head. I'm going to have her come and do this thing.
Yeah.
Right? So,
you never know.
And the people that I know here that are successful in that way, right? You know, Casey and Craig and Ace and people who book, they're all very strong personalities who try to get rid of fear, right? And I think fear is the thing that holds you back from being able to do the stuff that you really want to do.
Yeah.
And you can't tell people not to be afraid, because that's like telling them not to be
human
or anything, like not to breathe, right? But, like, it's a process. Work on it.
Yeah.
You know, and you see where you can go.
So, awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.